Up here at the front, and I think the first order of business is really to thank you all for coming out. This is a great turnout. This is a project that obviously a lot of people are interested in, and we appreciate you taking the time to come here. Also here we have a court reporter whose name is Sherry. She is going to be taking down everything that's said today once we get started formally, and so I would ask that when you do have comments during the public hearing period, that you do say your name, where you come from, and speak very loudly and very clearly to the extent you can. We have John Smith, who is, serves as the Commission's general counsel. And we've got Greg Rizlov, who serves as the Commissioner's advisor on these kinds of issues. We have TransCanada over here. And over here we've got staff members. Now, the Commission staff operates separately from the Commissioners in a docketed proceeding like this. We're the deciders, and they are representing the public interest. They are making a case on behalf of the state of South Dakota as to what the commissioners should do, and they will render recommendations accordingly. We have Martin Bettman, who is a staff engineer, Carrie Van Bakkern, who is a staff attorney, and we have Nathan Solem and Bob Knadel, who are also somewhere here in the building. So they will put probably hundreds and thousands of hours into this case, as certainly will the company officials. So thanks to staff for their help. With that, let's go ahead and begin the public input hearing for docket. Oh, one final note. We will be passing around the sign-up sheet. Some of you came in through the side door, so probably did not get an opportunity to sign the sign-in sheet. And as it goes by, if you've already signed it, don't sign it again. But if you haven't signed it, then please make sure to sign your name to that. With that, we're going to go ahead and begin the public input hearing for docket number HP07-001. And as you all know, that deals with the application by TransCanada Keystone Pipeline for a permit to construct the Keystone Pipeline project. The date today is June 25th. The time is approximately 11 o'clock in the morning, and we're here in Yankton, South Dakota. This hearing concerns an application for the permit to construct the pipeline. There are really two purposes. The commissioners view this public hearing as having two purposes. The first is for the company to better explain its application to interested citizens, and the second is for interested citizens to provide comments and questions, concerns to the commissioners so that we know what sort of factors are important to you when it comes time to render our decision. Interested persons, that's any of you, have the right to present your views and comments regarding the application, and we sincerely want to encourage you to do so. I should note that a copy of the application is on file with the Marshall, Day, Clark, Beadle, Kingsbury, Miner, Hansen, McCook, Hutchinson, and Yankton County Auditors. You all may also access the application and documents in the file under the Commission's website at www.puc.sd.gov, and any one of the Commission staff members can help walk you through the best way to do that if you're curious. Now, right now, the parties to this proceeding are the applicant, which is TransCanada, the Commission, and numerous other interested persons who have requested and been given party status. Under South Dakota law, each municipality, county, and governmental agency in the area where the facility is proposed to be constructed, or any interested person or entity, may be granted party status in this proceeding by making written application to the Commission on or before July 10, 2007. That is, I think, about not quite 2 weeks away, probably just about at 2 weeks away. We do have applications available here today if you would like to apply for party status. This is probably as good a time as any to make a couple of comments about party status. When you apply to gain party status, you are a legal intervener in the case. And I'll get to the rights and responsibilities that come with that in a little bit, but I'm going to make a presumption that a lot of you here today want two things. Number one, you want to retain your rights as a landowner. You want to make sure that all of the rights are, you retain those. And also, you want to make your comments heard. This is going to be one of a number of steps along the process where we will solicit input from you all. You do not have to be an intervener to have your voice heard. You can speak at this public hearing, any of the other three we have scheduled this week. You could write a letter or an email to the commission, really at almost any time during the process, and that would be entered into the record. There will likely be another opportunity, another public hearing, toward the end of the process where you would also have an opportunity to make your views heard. If you want to make your views, you do not need to be an intervener. I should also note that this is really, if it's not the beginning of the process, it's very close to the beginning of the process. The commissioners aren't going to be cross-examining TransCanada. We may ask some clarifying questions, but this is not really the formal evidentiary part of this proceeding. Some number of weeks or months down the road, we may get to that point. But this is really an informational opportunity for everybody to learn more about it. We're not going to be making a decision today, and we're not going to be making a decision this week, and we're not going to be making a decision this month. And so if down the road, if you do have comments you want us to know, please feel free to let us know. I think there's a perception out there that the commission has a lot to do with land acquisition or condemnation or eminent domain, and we don't. The statutes that we operate under say that we really need to take a look at the environmental impacts, and we need to make sure that a project like this isn't going to interfere with the orderly development of a region, and that it doesn't do that it's unlikely to do significant damage to individuals or areas. It does not really give us the authority to examine things like condemnation and eminent domain. That's really a circuit court issue, so I wanted to make that aware. For those of you who think you'd be interested in party status, you need to know that that means you're going to participate in the formal legal proceedings. Those are things like discovery, legal motions, introduction of evidence, and cross-examination of witnesses at the formal hearing, as well as briefing and arguing the legal and factual issues before the commission. Those people who are formal parties to this case would be subject to discovery if they are parties, and to cross-examination if they present evidence at the formal hearing. If those of you that have applied for party status think, maybe I don't want to be a formal intervener, that's fine. We want anybody into the case who wants to be in, and we're certainly, if people would prefer to just be interested party rather than a formal legal party, we can certainly make sure that you get wherever you want to be as part of this proceeding. Now, for its permit to be approved, the applicant must show that the proposed pipeline will comply with all applicable laws and rules, that the pipeline will not pose a threat of serious injury to the environment or to the social and economic condition of inhabitants or expected inhabitants in the siting area, that the pipeline will not substantially impair the health, safety, or welfare of the inhabitants, and that the pipeline will not unduly interfere with the orderly development of the region, with due consideration having been given to the views of governing bodies of each affected local units of government. Based on those factors, the Commission will decide whether the permit for the project should be granted, denied, or granted upon such terms, conditions, or modifications of the construction, operation, or maintenance of the facilities as the Commission finds appropriate. There's also a part of South Dakota state law that makes it clear that the Commission does not get to pick the exact route. We don't have the opportunity to go parcel by parcel or section by section across South Dakota and say this is exactly where we want the pipeline to go. We can grant, modify, or deny the application, but the exact site is not something that the state of South Dakota has given itself authority to do. We will begin this hearing by having the applicant make a presentation to explain its proposed project. Now, at our most recent June 12th hearing, we asked TransCanada to hold its presentation of 45 minutes. Following that presentation, we're going to take comments from interested persons, and we want to encourage landowners and others here today to present your views. I should also, as I mentioned earlier, you can provide your comments in writing. All right, with that, and I'll make more comments about the public hearing portion once TransCanada is done, but at this time, let's go ahead and turn over to Brett Kennecke, who is TransCanada's attorney in this proceeding, and we would ask Mr. Kennecke to introduce the others that he has brought with him from TransCanada.
Thank you very much, Commissioner. I appreciate all the commissioners and staff who are here today. Certainly all of the people in the audience, thank you for turning out. My name is Brett Kennecke. I'm a lawyer from Peer, and I represent TransCanada in this proceeding. I've got with me a number of people from TransCanada and people who work for TransCanada. Only three of them are going to participate in the 45-minute presentation that we're going to be giving you here this morning. However, we did bring along people who might be able to answer questions if necessary going on further through this process this morning. I want you all to know that we've looked forward to this part of the process. We look forward to engaging in a dialogue with you in front of the commission about the project, about what it's going to do and not going to do, where it's going to be and not going to be, and those sorts of things. So we really do look forward to your input and hope that we have a really good proceeding here today. The three gentlemen who will be presenting are Robert Jones. He's the vice president with TransCanada and responsible for the Keystone project. Mike Koski is an engineer from Florida who's been contracted to provide a number of administrative and other talents with respect to the pipeline. And Buster Gray is seated next to him. And Buster is an engineer from Houston by way of Kansas City, and he's responsible for design and construction with respect to the pipeline. So we'll look forward to a brief presentation from these guys. I'm the official timekeeper for you fellas, so don't run over the time. And thank you very much for coming.
Thank you, Brent.
Well, it is a pleasure to be here. I am really looking forward to a dialogue, being able to explain the Keystone project to you, how important this project is, and I look forward to being able to answer many, many of your questions. So let me proceed. Many of you think that TransCanada must be a foreign utility way up north. It's not true. TransCanada actually has more pipeline assets in the United States than we do in Canada. We've been in operation for over 50 years. We laid our first piece of pipe in 1957, and so we've been in operation since then, and we've been able to accumulate up to $24 billion worth of assets. So we're also a very strong financial company. When we were developing the pipeline over the years, and we've grown to 36,500 miles, we now have associated with us 40,000 landowners. We have our project office is in Kansas City. We have offices throughout the United States. We're in Nebraska. We're in Oregon, Michigan, Illinois. So we are, and certainly also in Houston. That's where our U.S. head office is. I believe it's very important for us to understand why Keystone needs to be built. And the main reason Keystone needs to be built can be shown on this graph. Canada has the second largest proven reserves in the world. There's approximately 175 billion barrels of proven oil reserves in Alberta. And there is probable, they call it the potential reserves, up to 300 billion barrels. As you can see, the number one country with reserves is Saudi Arabia, and five of the top six countries are Middle Eastern countries. The U.S. economy consumes 20 million barrels of oil every day. And Canada is the largest country, largest supplier of oil to the United States today. Following Canada is Saudi Arabia, Venezuela, and Mexico. Oil output is forecasted to grow out of Alberta from approximately 2 million barrels today to 3 million barrels by 2015. So tremendous amount of investment, and a lot of that investment is from U.S. energy companies. They're investing money to produce the oil in Alberta. The oil needs to go to market, and the market for crude oil is refineries. And refineries produce products that we use every day. We need gasoline for our cars. We need diesel for our trucks. We need lube oils, fertilizer, aviation fuel, and asphalt for our roads. These are all outputs of the refinery. So the Keystone Pipeline is the connection between this massive, reliable reserve in Canada and U.S. markets and refineries that supply the U.S. Midwest. Keystone is a 435,000-barrel-a-day pipeline. It's got the capacity to expand to approximately 590,000 barrels a day. To demonstrate the need for this pipeline, there was an open season process. This is a commercial process where we solicited energy companies and we were able to get 340,000 barrels a day of binding contracts with an average term of 18 years. So these are U.S. energy companies who have signed binding contracts with the Keystone Pipeline for up to 18 years. In fact, most of the contracts are for 20 years. We are the trucker. Keystone does not own the product. We just move the product. So the oil in the product is owned by the energy companies. It's not owned by TransCanada or Keystone. We're hoping to be able to expand this pipeline to also serve the refineries in Oklahoma, and those refineries also serve the Midwest. And when we do that, we're going to have to build a 300-mile extension through Kansas and down into Oklahoma. I would like to make this point very clear. Keystone is not connected with the recent announcement of a potential refinery in South Dakota. We are not part of that project. That is a potential project. Keystone has contracts to serve refineries in Wood River, Patoka, and Cushing. I'd like to just describe the project. Keystone is an 1,800-mile-long pipeline. Approximately 1,082 miles will be required to be constructed in the U.S. The pipeline will operate at a pressure of about 1,440 psi, but during our first phase, when we're at 435,000 barrels, the operating pressure will be less than 1,000 psi. Like a good Canadian, the pipeline is shaped like a hockey stick. The reason it is, okay, get my pointer working here. This part of the pipeline, we're converting an existing natural gas pipeline. So that pipeline's already in the ground. And that's the premise why it has this route. In other words, we didn't go straight because we're reutilizing an existing pipeline across the prairies in Canada. So then, if that's the blade, the shaft is the direct route right down, straight shot to Cushing. In order to move the oil, we need pumps. And the pumps are located approximately 50-mile spacings, and they're electrically driven series motors. The Keystone Pipeline is regulated both federally and state by various agencies. And in order to construct a pipeline across an international boundary, you need to get a presidential permit. And therefore, the Department of State, or DOS, is the lead agent. And they are responsible as the lead agent to prepare an environmental impact statement under NEPA. And NEPA is the National Environmental Policy Act. The project will also be reviewed by the Corps of Engineers, Fish and Wildlife Service, and the Department of Transportation, if you're wondering what those letters stand for. In South Dakota, the South Dakota Energy Conversion and Transmission Facilities Act authorizes the siting and the construction of the project, and that's really why we're here today. We're a part of that process. Other South Dakota agencies that have a role in reviewing this project are the Department of Environment and Natural Resources and the State Historic Preservation Office. We are seeking permits and approvals to start construction in the spring of 2008. And at that time, we will have been in regulatory process for up to 2 years. In fact, well over 2 years. So what are the benefits for the Keystone Project? During construction, there will be a number of short-term benefits. They result in food and lodging as construction crews move along the right-of-way. And those personnel will be visiting towns and cities along the right-of-way as they're building the pipeline. Over the two-year process. It takes 2 years to build the pipeline. It's scheduled to go in service in the fourth quarter of 2009. The construction contractors are going to need a number of supplies from local businesses. They're going to need fuel. They're going to need hardware, equipment, parts. They're going to need gravel, sand, and aggregate, concrete from various suppliers. The long-term economic benefit to the local communities will be paid annually in taxes. We estimate, under today's current capital cost estimate, $6.5 million will be paid in taxes to the counties and school districts along the pipeline right away. In addition to this property tax, there will be sales and contract excise tax from the initial construction of the pipeline as well. There will not be a number of permanent employees. We're going to basically use a lot of contract employees. For the four pump stations in South Dakota, we're going to need two permanent journeyman electricians and a pipeline technician. But we are going to need 50 to 60 contractors to help support our operating and maintenance activities and also to support our emergency response activities. Now, I'd like Mr. Mike Koski to come and talk to you about route selection and the environmental impacts.
Thank you, Robert. Good morning, Commission. Good morning, everybody. Thank you very much for coming. As Robert mentioned, I'm going to run through the route selection process for the Keystone Project and pipelines in general, and touch on the environmental impact assessment work that's been ongoing and the mitigation of environmental impacts. This is a snapshot of the facilities proposed for South Dakota. It's approximately 220 miles of 30-inch pipeline, four pump stations, and 15 mainline valves. The route selection process is an iterative process. It takes quite a while. We've been doing this for over 2 years, working on this particular route. The first step in the process is to identify the project objectives. It's basically, what's the project supposed to do? What's it supposed to accomplish? So in this case, we've got oil in northern Alberta and Canada, and refineries with a need for oil in Wood River, in Patoka, Illinois. And as I'll explain here in a second, the markets went through a slight evolutionary process whereby the markets actually changed partway, and that kind of affects the route selection story here somewhat. The basic objectives involved utilizing an existing natural gas pipeline in Canada, as Robert explained, starting in northern Alberta and ending at the markets I just discussed. The initial market points were Salisbury, Missouri, and the two in Illinois. And then subsequent to that, Cushing, Oklahoma became an important point for the project. The next step is to identify control points. Control points are basically the dots through which we need to or want to route the pipeline. That certainly includes where the oil comes from. It includes where the oil has to go. But it also includes some important features along the way, such as major river crossings, if there's a gap between two national parks or something of that nature that really kind of defines where you should go. So those sort of form the initial dots through which we draw a line. The next step after connecting those dots is to start gathering data, a lot of data. We start with publicly available environment, soils, land use information. We talk to agencies. We get information from there, aerial photography, mapping, and that's all gathered together. And we use that information to identify what we refer to as constraints and opportunities. Constraints are areas that we either want to avoid or to minimize going through. Those are things such as a national park, areas of extensive wet areas, poor soils, items of that nature. And opportunities are places where we like to go, or it's preferable for us to go. And probably the most significant opportunity relative to pipeline construction or pipeline routing is existing linear facilities such as power lines and pipelines. And the map here on the left, it's probably a little difficult to see where we are, but it's a network of existing pipelines throughout South Dakota. There's gas lines, there's liquid lines, and those are things we look at to identify if there's an opportunity to co-locate with something. Unfortunately, in South Dakota, other than a few discrete locations, there isn't a long existing pipeline that goes where we want to go. The next step after identifying all that is to come up with some alternatives. You get to sit down in a room full of people. We've got engineers, construction experts, biologists, environmental folks, land people, and we start coming up with a number of alternatives based on aerial photography and mapping. We then take those and we hit the field. We do aerial reconnaissance. We drive around looking at a lot of stuff. and we narrow that down to a preferred option, which, again, we're not done yet, but that's the preferred option with which we then go to agencies, we lay it out, seek additional input, we have open houses, we lay out to the public what our thoughts are, and we solicit more input. And then we circle back in, go through most of these points all again, and it happens over and over again until you converge on a route that's suitable for filing for a detailed environmental review. Now, we certainly heard a lot of suggestions associated with I-29. And at first glance, it appears like an absolute viable option. It's something that should be looked at. And in fact, we did look at it. It is an existing linear feature. I mentioned that we like to follow existing linear features, and it is one. And it roughly goes where we want to go, at least a portion of it. At the early stage of the project, when we were going to Missouri, Salisbury, Missouri, and Illinois, we were not going to Cushing, Oklahoma. Our route actually went through Iowa at that time. And we did, at that time, evaluate an I-29 option. Now, there's two ways one can utilize I-29. You could go within the roadway right-of-way, or you can go adjacent to it. We never considered going in the roadway right-of-way for a number of reasons, and this certainly comes up on projects throughout the U.S. The interstates, just by their very nature, involve an awful lot of interchanges and overpasses. Just in North Dakota and South Dakota alone, on I-29, there's over 100 interchanges, and that's not including the overpasses. At each one of those, you've got on-ramps, off-ramps, you've got bridge abutments. It gets very complicated. And then add on top of that, that tends to be where commercial development exists, and also towns, villages, cities. So it very quickly becomes an exercise of having to leave the right-of-way frequently to go around this stuff. And very soon you realize that instead of avoiding impacting private landowners, you're actually adding more of them. Other considerations are highway departments tend not to like major facilities like ours in the right-of-way, as it's an impediment to maintenance and expansion. If additional lanes are required or new overpasses, it's a continual problem for them. And also, there is certainly the safety aspect of constructing a large diameter crude oil pipeline in direct vicinity with traffic on I-29 or any interstate. So I mentioned there was two options. The other option was to follow adjacent to I-29. Again, you still have the same problem with overpasses and interchanges. You're still kicking away from the route repeatedly, and you end up increasing the length overall and impacting even more landowners. So then when I-29 was being considered as an alternative, it was rejected, and that was when, as I said, we were going to Missouri and Illinois. When we added Cushing, that then threw another dynamic. Basically, that forces the project to go further south before it heads east in order to economically serve Cushing as well as Wood River and Patoka. And that throws into play a Missouri River crossing. Now, the Missouri River, as everybody knows, is a pretty large river, pretty active. Large sections of it are designated under the Wild and Scenic Rivers Act. There's a desire by many agencies to let that river go back to its natural course, to let it wander all over like it used to and like it still is. And so we had to really look carefully to find a reasonable crossing location for that. And we looked up and down the river and landed on Yankton, South Dakota, right here as the preferred location. It's a narrow reach of the river. It's very stable. It hasn't moved much over time. It's just downstream of the dam, and there's two existing pipeline crossings right there. So that sort of becomes one of those control points I mentioned to you, and that is right here. What did you do to it, Robert? There we go. Roughly there. So that's roughly 30 miles west of I-29. When you combine that with an entry point into the U.S. of roughly near Walhalla, North Dakota, that's about 35 miles west of I-29. So you end up with two significant control points that have you west of I-29, and that further takes it out of play as a viable option. The project is subject to intense environmental review. As Robert mentioned, the Department of State is a lead federal agency. There are a number of other cooperating agencies in that process, and they are in the midst right now of preparing the environmental impact statement. In support of its applications, Keystone has filed extensive environmental information with both Department of State and other lead federal agencies, involving detailed desktop and field surveys for cultural, wetlands, biology, threatened and endangered species. It's been feet of binders have been filed with the various agencies to describe the impacts and mitigation associated with the project. A summary of impacts is provided. Can't quite get this mic placement. In the South Dakota application, which covers all major resource areas. A key part of all of our applications has been what we call a construction mitigation and reclamation plan, which is our book of rules and specifications and procedures that how we describe how we're going to construct and, most importantly, reclaim various types of areas of the project. That includes water bodies, wetlands, farmland. It's all spelled out in intimate detail from the day construction starts through to when it ends, and then afterwards, the monitoring and the follow-up required after construction. That is outlined in there. It's a key component of all of our applications and will be part of our approvals. And with that, I'd like to turn it over to Buster Gray to talk a little bit about land and construction.
Good morning. As Mike has indicated, I'll try and cover a couple of topics that I'm responsible for on the project. And the land acquisition program and the engineering and construction fall under my responsibility. Briefly to describe in the land, and I apologize at the size of the slides that they're going to be difficult to see. But we will typically take about 110-foot construction right-of-way to construct the pipeline. 50 feet of that is permanent easement, 60 feet of it is temporary easement, and then we have what we call additional workspaces. If we cross a stream, road, railroad, some topographic feature that we need space to put soil or dirt is typically what we need, then we would take additional workspace for that. As many of you would be aware, we are in our land acquisition phase. We've been acquiring right-of-way here in South Dakota now for approximately 2 months. And if that program has been a little more prevalent in the northern part of the state to work into the southerly part of the state, but many of you may or may not have been contacted at this point in time, but you will in the near future. The key point that I want to make in this meeting is the company's policy is to pay fair market value for the easement itself. Our policy is to pay 50% of fair market value for the temporary easement and temporary workspace. And our policy is to pay 3 years of crop damages, 100% the first year, 75% the second year, and 50% the third year. That is the compensation program that will be presented to you if it has not been presented to you to date. Other things, and I mentioned other damages, and those are that if there are very unique damages to your property, you will be compensated for those damages as well. The other point that's on this slide is that with a pipeline being a buried utility is that we will retain some rights under our easement that you cannot build a structure in the 50 feet and some other rights that are stated in it. But as far as the full use and enjoyment of the property relative to agricultural production, it's our belief that over this 3-year period we can return your land to normal productivity. But in the event that we cannot, we are responsible for any post damages past that period. You see three names noted, and again, if you have difficulty with these, they're actually some phone numbers on the flyer that are out there. Ultimately, we have a state supervisor in Huron, South Dakota, that's responsible for land acquisition in the state, a land manager where I'm located in Kansas City, and then a TransCanada representative. The main point of these contacts are if you are treated unfairly, or if you feel like you are treated with disrespect, or you're treated in any manner that you believe is strong-handed, I strongly suggest you to contact one of these individuals. If you don't find satisfaction with those, you can certainly contact myself. This graphic, again, is going to be difficult, I think, for you to see, but a pipeline construction is an assembly line. We build a pipeline much like an automobile factory builds an automobile, except in an automobile factory, the worker stays stationary, the product moves by the worker. In a pipeline construction, the pipe stays stationary, and various crews move along this particular route building the pipeline. In this particular graphic, one of the points that I wanted to make here is that this will be comprised of approximately 350 to 450 construction workers, starting with crews at the front end that are surveying and clearing, all the way to your pipe installation, which at the end then you have your lower end and your testing and your cleanup. This assembly line, or spread as we call it in our industry, it from the front crews to the back crews is typically about 50 to 60 miles. The construction will progress at about a mile and a quarter to a mile and a half a day. And the typical landowner, and we always have to wrap it around weather conditions, we believe will be impacted approximately 8 to 12 weeks once we start construction. The next series of slides, and I'm going to try and run down them, is just showing some of the assembly line steps that we talk about. And one of the key items of building a pipeline in the Midwest is restoring your land to its former productivity in it. And Mr. Koski mentioned the Construction Mitigation and Reclamation Plan. It spells out techniques and methods like this, which is topsoil stripping, where we literally remove the topsoil from an area of the construction right away. Once we complete construction, we replace it. Next operation from pipe yards we would make along the construction right away, we would haul the pipe to the right away. We use a term called stringing, where we string the pipe along the construction right away. And people find it somewhat hard to believe that this large diameter pipe, but we literally have to bend it to fit the topography of the earth and also to make turns in the pipeline, and there are hydraulic machines that will do that. This represents excavation of the trench line. We use two different methods, a wheel trencher or back hose. My personal thoughts is probably the southern two-thirds of the state would probably be excavated with wheel trenchers, the northern maybe third by backhoe, simply because for me it has appeared to be wetter in the northern stretches. The pipes joined together by welding, and we use either a manual stick weld technique or we use an automatic welding technique. Both of those methods that are utilized would either be inspected by radiography or ultrasonic inspection. Both of those technologies are very similar to what you would see in a medical facility. The next slide is that where we make the welds, we cannot have a mill coating. We have to coat that in the field, and it's generally either spray or brush applied field joint coating. And then the entire coating of the pipeline is checked with a device we call a Jeep. And it literally is an electronic device that goes along the length of the pipe. And if there's a nick or damage in the coating, it makes a jeeping sound, and it's repaired or patched before it goes in. Long sections of pipe are lowered into the trench in very long sections, maybe 2,000 to 3,000 feet in length, in which they're tied in together with underground wells called tie-in wells. This slide just represents the padding and backfill. If we run into rock or other material that could be damaging to the coating of the pipeline, we will put a padding material around the pipe. If there's no material like that, but we would just use the spoil material out of the trench. But even if we use padding material, it would be made from the soil that comes out of the trench. I mentioned before we push the topsoil to one side of the right of way, and we'll bring it back and spread it over the entire width of the right of way. Foreign utilities are other utilities. Anytime you build a linear project like a pipeline, you literally cost hundreds, if not thousands, of existing utilities, whether they're fiber optic cables, other pipelines, water lines, sewer lines. We generally work with the utility owner for requirements to cross those utilities, and we typically cross beneath them. We're required by code to have a 1 foot clearance or separation with the existing utilities. Any improved or well-used road will be bored, will not be open cut, and that's simply to relieve our concerns of maintenance of it in the future. Once the pipeline's completed, it'll be filled with water, typically taken from a river or a stream along the pipeline where the route would pump full of water, and the pipeline is pressure tested to 125% of the maximum operating pressure of the pipeline. Those records are recorded and they're maintained for the life of the pipeline. The other device that you see is what we call a caliper pig. It's an electronic device that checks the geometry of the pipeline. If for any reason we have dented or buckled the pipe during the course of construction, this device would locate it and we would remove that damage prior to putting the pipeline in service. Lastly is reclamation. And these slides represent three things that we've experienced in the Midwest. With our heavy equipment compaction is probably the most damage that we can do to your farmland. And we bring and we rip the soil to relieve compaction, much like I assume periodically that you guys do yourself on your farms. Rock picking is that with our construction rock or glacial till in this area, we typically pick that up back to the density and the size that existed on the adjacent right-of-ways. And lastly, we if allowed, we will seed to try and get ground cover back on areas so that erosion can be prevented. This particular slide is a before construction and after construction of a same location. And the key point of this slide is we will make every effort to restore the land and the productivity, but we will not make the statement that we can restore it to 100%. We will restore it to the best of our ability. We believe we can bring the agricultural land back to its original production. And this slide simply represents that it is put back to a level that's good with the environment. But we don't want to leave the impression that anybody would tell you it would be exactly the same. I believe with this, I'll turn it back to Robert Jones.
Thank you, Buster. How are we doing for time here? We're still good? Excellent. I appreciate your patience. I know this is a long presentation, but there's a lot of information we're trying to get out to you. Keystone's key regulations and standards, Keystone is subjected to federal compliance with federal regulations and, of course, with national codes.
These regulations are intended to protect the public, our employees, and the environment. And obviously our goal is to prevent any pipeline leaks. So to do that, we have a lot of design safety features. To minimize the risk of damage, the top of the pipe will be buried 48 inches below the surface of the ground. That exceeds code. Code is 30 inches. So Keystone is 48 inches. We're going to use high strength steel from the mills. The pipe will be externally coated when it comes out of the mill. It'll be coated with an epoxy coating that is fused to the steel. If there is a damage in the coating when it's in the pipe, an additional protection is cathodic protection. Cathodic protection is a low voltage electric current that's applied to the pipeline. I'm going to talk about SCADA protection and leak detection in the next slide. Marker signs, when we cross an area where we think somebody may be excavating over the pipeline, or like the case of that, like a railway crossing or a road crossing, there'll be marker signs where the pipeline crosses that crossing. And isolation valves. A number of isolation valves. I believe Mr. Koski mentioned that there'll be 15 isolation valves, and that is to provide additional environmental protection in the unlikely event of a leak, because it minimizes the area of exposure. TransCanada has developed, over its 50 years of experience, a quality control and a quality assurance program that begins with the acquisition of the steel. So we first inspect the steel to make sure it meets the properties of the codes, the national codes and our standards. We are exceeding all codes and all standards. That QCQA follows through to the fabrication of the pipe, the delivery of the pipe right to site, and Buster went through all the construction activities as well. I think it's very important for you to understand that when we fill after fabricating the whole pipe, we fill it full of water and we test it to 125% of its maximum allowable pressure, and that ensures that we find any possible defects or flaws that might have been in the pipe or in any of the welds. The entire pipeline system is monitored 24 hours a day, 365 days a year, by highly skilled employees in a control center. And we also have a fully redundant control center. The SCADA computer system detects any changes in pressure or any upsets along the pipeline and ensures that the facilities are operating properly. And if there's an incident, we'll shut the line down immediately. A dedicated leak detection system monitors the volume balances within the pipeline. The best way to explain that is we measure what goes in, we measure what goes out, and they have to be the same. Pipeline maintenance. TransCanada has a very extensive pipeline maintenance program, again, that we've developed over our 50 years of experience. We've got years of experience inspecting pipelines and repairing pipelines. Some of the activities we do to ensure that there isn't any damage of the line is aerial patrol to make sure nobody is digging over top or has an unauthorized crossing. One of the key pipeline maintenance features are these pigs. Buster showed you a picture of this computerized tool that goes in the line. We call them smart pigs. And we are scheduled to run one of these smart pigs within the first 3 years, and that would look for any possible pipeline anomaly that may have passed the hydro test but still is in the line. Once we've got the data, we'll go and investigate the defect and we'll repair it immediately. We'll participate in a number of public awareness programs and to make sure that people know that the pipeline is there so that they don't dig over it without authorization. You certainly can cross the pipeline with our authorization, and we're going to participate in the South Dakota One Call program. Keystone will be submitting a detailed oil spill response plan with PHMSA. PHMSA is the federal regulator for pipelines, prior to the commencement of operation. Spill response and cleanup equipment will be located prior to operations, will be pre-positioned at locations that are determined by this spill analysis, and that spill analysis is based on the worst possible discharge case. So it'll be it'll most likely have a safety factor built well into any potential unlikely event of a spill. If there is a spill, in the unlikely event that we do have a leak, Keystone will remediate the area under the direction and coordination of federal regulators and state agencies. TransCanada's commitment. We've worked hard to be a good neighbor in the communities that we have a presence. We do that by respecting the health and safety and well-being of our employees, our contractors, and the communities. And we look forward to being a part of the community here in South Dakota. As Buster mentioned, you can contact us at any time. We have a website. We have a 1-800 number. And all stakeholders are reminded that they can contact us in either one of these forums. So that concludes our presentation. I thank you for your patience, and I look forward to your questions.
Thank you very much, Mr. Kennecke, and everybody else from TransCanada. I think at this point, we'll see if the commissioners have any clarifying questions, and then after that, we will go to the public comment.